President of the university, the governor of this state, and distinguished guest. If you think I am bluffed by the presence of such a large crowd, you are making a mistake. I know why you are here. You are not here because you think the man who stands before you is of any importance. You are curious to see how a pensioner who is unemployed looks like. Now a pensioner looks like me. It is a great honor to have been invited to deliver this lecture in the name of Anwar al-Sadat, a great African leader and man who in his life faced and dealt with the complex challenges of making peace, whether within a single nation or amongst nations. One can, of course, not speak of Anwar Sadat without thinking and paying tribute to his great mentor and presidential predecessor, Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser. His name shines brightly in the gallery of African heroes, liberators, and statesmen. And we salute his memory tonight. Many of you will remember that in Africa here, there were two blocks, the Monrovia Group and the Casablanca Group. The Casablanca Group was the most progressive in its attitude towards the liberation movements in Africa and in relation to its attitude towards the Western world. And Egypt, under Colonel Nasser, as well as King Mohammed V of Morocco, Algeria, Ghana, and Mali were in the Casablanca Group. And it is in the light of this background that in addition to Anwar Sadat, we think of Colonel Nasser. It was thought proper to give as the title to our own autobiography the phrase, and I quote, "Long walk to freedom," unquote. I shall not pretend to be a literary critic, even where it concerns a work written by myself. What I can say about that phrase is that it not only signals retrospectively the length of struggle to attain freedom and peace, it is also, one hopes, a call to readers to be ever attentive that the struggle for freedom and peace is a continuing one, we do not ever reach an end to a road where we can sit down and lay down tools. Recent and current events in the world have forced us to renew and perhaps even in new ways to focus on the complexities of maintaining, establishing, and consolidating peace in our own planet. We were hopeful that the beginning of the new century was increasingly witnessing the dawn of consensus about global responsibility for peace. The terrible audacity of the events of 11 September 2001 shook all of us out of preconceptions about peace and security in the world. It is not clear that we have already fully comprehended the implications and consequences of what happened on that day. But surely, the world will not be the same after those events. The events, with such a cold-blooded efficiency, executed in the heart of the most powerful nation in the world, reminded that of all the world, as the entire world stands exposed to terrorism, that confounds because of its utter and ultimate lack of respect for law and convention. Acts of terrorism have, of course, not been confined to those we saw in New York and Washington on the 11th of September. Many parts of the world, too many parts in fact, continue to be haunted by this scourge that is terrorism. It assumes many forms and presents itself as in service of many causes. Its moral issues is around the pursuit, I must say, I know a president of a big country who used to confuse his papers. He would start from page one and go to page five and come back to page three, and he would then read and finish his speech without discovering that he had made a mistake. At least I know I made a mistake. I say that terrorism assumes many forms and presents itself as in service of many causes. Its defining feature is its ruthless and deliberate attack on innocent civilians. It was the perversely spectacular nature of the events of 11 September and not that other lives lost are less valued than those that focused the world's mind anew on the threat of terrorism. It starkly confronted us with some of the ultimate implications of the ultimate lack of respect for law and convention. We have had occasion to express ourselves publicly in support of the current military actions by the United States and Britain in pursuit of those they identified as the perpetrators of the acts of terror. We accept that the United States and Britain are bent on bringing to book the identified terrorists, and that the unfortunate civilian casualties that arise are coincidental. We accept that they will and are taking all precautions possible within a war situation to minimize civilian casualties and suffering. But before I proceed, there are certain hard facts we must accept about this attack on the 11th of September. The efficient manner in which it was executed, The efficient manner in which it was executed shows that the preparations for this attack must have taken a long time indeed. I wouldn't be surprised if those preparations took more than 2 years. What is disturbing is that the West, with all its technology, its intelligence services, its enormous resources, was unable to have a clue of what was being prepared. And they only became aware when the attack was actually launched. That has serious implications and challenges some of the platitudes which the West has repeatedly told us, that they are superior in intelligence to the developing world. And the fact that they had no clue whatsoever of such elaborate preparations has got serious implications. The tragedy of war, and therefore one of the main reasons why we should redouble our collective efforts to create a world in which war shall have no place, is that inevitable innocent civilians and bystanders suffer and die in the process of war infrastructure, so vital to the lives of ordinary citizens, gets destroyed. This is undoubtedly happening again in the military activities conducted by the United States and Britain in Afghanistan. Those in that country, already so devastated by war and conflict, who refuse to cooperate with the international forces against terrorism, have brought this war on the country and are the ones in the first place responsible for this further tragic suffering. We must wish that the military action needed in pursuit of the objectives against terrorism will be concluded in the shortest time possible, and that the world attention can turn to other forms of action required to combat and eradicate terrorism, thereby creating a safer and more secure world for all. We trust that the international community and agencies will be giving all the humanitarian assistance possible to the people of Afghanistan, now already in the conditions of war, and also on the longer term as that country needs it to be reconstructed after so much war and suffering. We must trust above all that in Afghanistan and all over the world, democracy will be established and the interest and well-being of the people will be supreme. We shall not be as arrogant to dictate that one particular form of democracy that we are used to and practice in our own country provides the answer to all situations. There are countries without the popular institutions we know that provide in the social and economic needs of their citizens to a far greater extent than many of the popular democracies. What one is asking for is that government serves the people and that the interest be the priority in national life. In a world where, as we now we are witnessing, the pursuit of peace and the conduct of war sometimes coincide, it is absolutely necessary that our international and multilateral bodies become more effective as agencies for conflict management, of conflict resolution and prevention, and in the fight against terrorism. The manner in which virtually all of the nations of the world responded to condemn terrorism provides the basis for multilateral action with the United Nations, particularly is a key in this regard. The support that the United States and Britain have received from the international community for their stance and action against terrorism must surely in future encourage them to lend their stronger support to making our world body an effective and potent agency for dealing with these international issues affecting peace and our common safety. Now, it is common knowledge that the First World War broke out in 1914 and ended 4 years later. 21 years later, the Second World War broke out and ended in 1945. It is now 56 years after the end of the Second World War. There has been no world war. Indeed, there have been many conflicts, civil and regional, but no world war. That is because we now have international bodies in which the majority of the states are members, and that the most dominant of all these is the United Nations, whose charter provides that all members must seek to resolve their problems through peaceful means. And therefore, it is the duty of every country, big and small, to respect the United Nations. We condemn.